Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Allie Irving for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. Our first article, Growing Up in Atlanta Taught Me to Revere MLK. Walking the Civil Rights Trail Helped Me Mourn Him. This year, I turned the age King was when he died. Visiting historic sites that honor him made 39 suddenly feel impossibly young. This article was written by Ninika M. Okona and published originally December 23, 2025. There is no Atlanta, and it could never be the same city in the spirit of radical lineage without calling to mind Martin Luther King, Jr. See, in Atlanta, we revere him. Martin Luther King, Jr. is like a family member, a dear friend or neighbor. We love him fiercely. His legacy is tangled up in a glowing reverence and gratitude. He is the person we look up to because of all he did for us, and we chant that to ourselves as a silent reminder. But this love, this ceaseless thankfulness, has not truly allowed any of us black people from here to unabashedly center our grief. When, other than at his funeral, which trailed through the streets of Atlanta, have we been permitted to wail in sorrow for him instead of burying that hurt for pride? Weeks after my own mother's death, I found myself unmoored near all the landmarks that were of significance to King and his life, places that are also included in Atlanta's entries on the Civil Rights Trail. My aims were simple. I wanted to distract myself from my ferocious grief at losing my last parent 2 years after the first with another, more ancient grief. I wanted all these big questions, most unanswerable, to hang in the balance as I walked and thought. I'm 39 years old, the same age King was when he was murdered in Memphis on April 4, 1968. As I began my quest, I allowed this haunting fact to settle over me. The heaviness of knowing that King was taken at such a crucial time in his life. As he questioned the future and the direction his politics would go, and knowing how truly young that age is, filled me with endless questions. I held these questions as I crossed the street and walked through a vestibule into the visitor center of the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historical Park, where I was immediately flooded with memories of visiting it during my childhood, before it became a site named after King in 2017. One of the park rangers, a younger black woman who looked to be around my age, handed me a brochure with a warm smile. The throngs of people overwhelmed me, and shortly after I walked out of the area, trying to ground myself in some quiet. I wondered, as I walked away from the buzz of the visitor center and toward the World Peace Rose Garden, how King felt at 39. Did he feel young? Did he feel old? Did he feel wistful, or a certain grief in the growing recognition that he may not live to become an elder? I knew that in the last years of his life, he struggled with debilitating depression, questioning his place in the world and whether his methods had been in vain. The racism that continued had upended him, despite facing the world with bold courage. Not wanting to tarry long at the garden, I continued on to his spiritual home, Ebenezer Baptist Church. When King returned to Atlanta in 1960, he became the co-pastor at this church, a church his father, Daddy King, had led while his son came into his theological self at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. His first sermon, The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life, was delivered on February 6, 1960, marking his homecoming and signaling growth. King's actual first sermon was delivered there in 1947 at only 18 years old. But as groups of people in matching t-shirts strolled in front of the church, hanging out underneath the blue and white sign facing the street and glowing in the afternoon sun, I pondered how it must have felt for him to blossom away from his father's shadow, only to be thrust back into it. The two certainly had different schools of thought on civil rights and activism. Daddy King thought his son was too confrontational in ways that threatened his safety. He wanted him to step back, not be as visible. Since the church was closed to visitors that day, I imagined the warmth of the building and the notes of gospel songs playing. In my mind, I could see the sanctuary and the pulpit, where King might have grasped each side of the lectern, sweat pouring down his face, as he gave his sermon in an impassioned speech. Still in a daze, I held the feeling of what it might have been to hear him speak, and walked away moved. And grief billowed in my chest. Mere steps away from his birth home, where King was born on January 15, 1929. It was closed for renovations, so I couldn't go in, but surrounded by others peering at it from the outside, I had a few conversations. I talked to the people from Detroit, Los Angeles, and New York. They were all stirred seeing these landmarks, most of them seeing them for the first time. Amid the emotionality, I was laser-focused on the gravity of where I was geographically. Auburn Avenue. King dwelled in Sweet Auburn, the neighborhood where this famed street is found. Sweet Auburn Historic District is in Atlanta's old Fourth Ward, but has been its own entity since 1976, when it received a National Historic Landmark designation and a listing on the National Register of Historic Places. This guided me as I took a detour and walked further down Auburn Avenue before deciding I'd loop around to the King Center. Auburn Avenue represents the long practice of Black ingenuity, progress, and entrepreneurship. Reflecting on King's legacy as it relates to Sweet Auburn and Auburn Avenue, and what the area has always meant for Black Atlantans, is essential to understanding our past and where we're headed in the future. But even in the fierce dedication to maintaining the legacy of Sweet Auburn, and a past that raised King himself, there are hard truths. Walking along Auburn Avenue feels like peering into a recent past that has been abandoned. Tucked in between storefronts from decades ago that are still operating, some that might have stood during King's time, are ones that are emptied, decorated with only the dust of old dreams. These certainly aren't new problems or worries, though. Through the years, community leaders have voiced their concerns in hope that resources could be allocated to both preserve Sweet Auburn and usher it into a new age, building on what it was in the past. Passing Cox Brothers and Hoggo Brooks, two Black-owned funeral homes within feet of each other, I thought about how, during the Jim Crow era, these were places of refuge in times of immense grief, where Black families could trust that their loved ones would be respected, even in death, when no one else would. Their existence then and their legacy, since neither still operates as a funeral home, matters. There were other sights and things I saw as I walked and mourned. Prince Hall Masonic Lodge, where King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference co-founders Bayard Rustin, Fred Shuttlesworth, and Ralph Abernathy strategized before they had their own office space. The new SCLC National Office further down the street. A mural beneath the Interstate 7585 connector underpass chronicling Auburn Avenue's history. At the end of Auburn Avenue, before crossing over onto Piedmont, I passed Four Keeps Bookstore, which specializes in rare, obscure, and otherwise hard-to-find books written by Black authors and literary luminaries. Atlantan Rosa Duffy, opened Four Keeps on Auburn in tribute to the street's historic significance. When I peeked in, I saw a Martin Luther King Jr. vinyl LP, In the Struggle for Freedom and Dignity, featuring a few of his recorded speeches. A glimmer of King somewhere else, unexpected. I wrapped up my walk of mourning, staring at where King and his wife, Coretta, are in their final resting place, at the backside of the King Center, within a conjoined crypt. Surrounding them is a reflection pool, one of Atlanta's most visited spots by tourists. This area, too, is felt through words and quotes inscribed on the ground, offering hope and perspective. As I wove in and out of foot traffic, I kept my eyes on the crypt, as if it were my North Star. Here I stood among many people, thinking, reflecting, taking pictures, and I still felt wrecked. Not uplifted, not hopeful. I naively thought this walk would comfort me or make the messiness of my morning neater. Instead, each landmark I had passed felt like a cartography of grief, many somewheres bigger than the sadness itself. I still hadn't wailed for myself or any others who held in our grief for King, but I had walked to try to remember. The next article is called My Kids Know the World is Messed Up. They're still excited to live in it. While I lose sleep over climate change, war, and disappearing jobs, my children see possibility everywhere. It's changing how I parent and how I live. This article was written by Emil Niazi and originally published January 8, 2026. A couple of months ago, my 8-year-old son and I were driving in the car. He was staring out the window while I listened to the news on the radio. As we were pulling into the grocery store parking lot, there was a particularly heartbreaking interview with a Canadian man whose relative in Palestine had lost his 3 children in the war. As I sat crying, my son asked why I was sad. As I started to fumble my way through some sort of explanation, he might understand, that wasn't too gruesome or scary, I finally just said, "A daddy lost his babies." Before having kids, my husband and I would blurt out whatever grim or bleak headline popped up on our phones and then pick apart the stories, wondering aloud what the hell was going on in the world. Now, he's anxious about the kids overhearing us and getting scared, taking in the information without context, and turning it around in their young minds, ending up with nightmares about blazing forests or villainous old men. I'm still trying to curb the impulse, though it's especially tricky these days when every hour seems to bring some deeply unsettling news about the state of the environment or the economy or some horrible confluence of both. I grew up in the 90s under a cloud of doom and gloom about the environment, a pit in my small stomach growing in tandem with the hole in the ozone layer. I used to have nightmares about acid rain where my skin would melt off during a thunderstorm, and I begged my broke parents to donate what precious little money they had to the World Wildlife Fund so we alone could save the pandas and the whales, no pressure. I went from that anxious wildlife-saving child to a journalist, someone acutely aware of all the ills of the world, watching bad news for a living. Then, in later years as a writer and columnist on the parenting beat, I pored over studies about the impact of stress and anxiety on the minds of young kids. I went from worrying about my footprint on the world to worrying about how my kids would survive it. Now, my 3 kids are growing up in an era of AI, where CEOs often speak joyfully about replacing millions of jobs with bots, when it's already getting harder and harder for young people to find entry-level work out of college. They're still contending with climate chaos, only now it's not a looming threat but a tangible part of their lives. Our family has spent several summers now where the smoke from nearby wildfires makes it dangerous for the kids to play outside for too long or see their grandpa out west. In 2023, when I was pregnant with my 3rd baby, Toronto had the worst air quality in the world for many days, and I was afraid to even leave the house for fear of risking his health. News headlines scream of wars, massacres, and political turmoil and toxicity. It's scary and confusing for me as a parent, so how could it not be scary and confusing for them? As much as I don't want them to be haunted by fears they can't yet name, let alone comprehend, it's clear they already have a growing awareness of the uglier parts of the world. As they start asking bigger questions about their place in it, about the future and who they might want to be when they grow up, or the life they imagine for themselves beyond the borders of our little home, I often wonder what I can do to keep them from feeling defeated before they've even begun their journeys. But the reality is, they are inherently optimistic and adaptable. These qualities are built in. When I actually talk to my kids about their ideas of the world, they don't have a sense of hopelessness, fear, or even anxiety. Their vision of the future is as expansive as a child's always is, always has been. Despite the disruptive threats of AI and what it could mean for our notions of work, my kids still dream of being writers and astronauts and artists. Where I see a foreboding change, one that can only mean less for them, not more, they see only a world full of possibility and potential. Kids are also naturally solution-focused. The other night, I was talking to mine about gratitude, especially as the temperature started to dip outside, and they were complaining about being cold out of the bath, despite it being balmy in their rooms. I mentioned some of our unhoused neighbors whose lives were at risk during the winter months because of the cold. They immediately suggested bringing them some of our extra blankets. However simplistic, they often tend toward fixing the problem rather than dwelling on it. During the pandemic, there was a reluctance to call kids resilient, or at least lamenting that just because they can be doesn't mean they should have to be. Yet their adaptability, their innate ability to move through the world with emotional elasticity, is their greatest superpower. As a kid, I was so sure the planet was dying, but rather than be defeated by it, I imagined myself as an environmental steward, someone whose donation to the right charity and membership in the school's eco club could and would make all the difference. I made my mom and dad give up their aerosol hairspray and deodorant cans, and, well, you can guess my pride when that hole in the ozone started closing. I think it's sometimes easier for us as parents to dwell on our own anxieties about our kids' futures rather than be honest with them about how powerless we feel we are to fix any of it. But their optimism for the future, that there will be a future, is the one thing giving me hope, because I can see these kids really will be all right. The next article is, can a simple blood test predict osteoporosis risk earlier than ever before? New research suggests higher alkaline phosphatase levels may be linked to higher bone turnover. This article is written by Corin Miller and published January 8, 2026. Being able to move as well as you do now when you're older is peak health goals, but osteoporosis can sneak up on people, especially women, and raise the risk of serious issues like fractures and pain as you age. Unfortunately, osteoporosis is known as a silent disease, which makes it hard to detect unless you're actively looking for it. Right now, screening involves imaging tests that usually require a trip to a specialized medical center or hospital. But new research suggests that a simple blood test may be able to predict osteoporosis risk, allowing doctors to intervene early and increase the odds you and your bones will be in peak condition for years. Here's what the research found, plus what doctors want you to keep in mind. What did the study find? The Frontiers in Endocrinology study analyzed data from people who took routine health exams between 2019 and 2024 at a teaching hospital. The researchers looked at a range of data, including various measurements and lab tests. Those tests included a blood test that measured total alkaline phosphatase, ALP, an enzyme that speeds up certain chemical reactions in your body. ALP is found in all your body's tissues, but it's usually found in higher amounts in your liver, bile ducts, and bones, according to the U.S. National Library of Medicine. The researchers discovered that people with osteoporosis had significantly higher levels of ALP in their blood compared to patients who didn't have osteoporosis. The link between ALP and osteoporosis was strongest in young women with normal liver enzymes who were metabolically healthy, meaning they didn't have underlying metabolic concerns like type 2 diabetes. Based on the findings, the researchers said ALP may be worth a closer look for detecting early signs of osteoporosis in the future. Why might this blood test help determine a person's osteoporosis risk? Elevated levels of ALP suggest someone is having increased bone turnover, which is linked with higher bone loss and a greater risk of fracture, explains Emmanuel Osei Boma, MD, a primary care physician at Mercy Medical Center in Baltimore, MD. While some other tests, like a DEXA scan, will give doctors more specific information about your bone health, total ALP remains a readily available screening tool that can identify individuals who may benefit from further osteoporosis evaluation, Dr. Osei Boma says. So, ALP can be useful, but it's not the only way doctors make an osteoporosis diagnosis. And on the flip side, having a high ALP could also point to other health conditions, according to Natalie Cusano, MD, an endocrinologist at Northwell's Lenox Hill Hospital. A high total alkaline phosphatase, could also point to other health conditions. It doesn't necessarily mean high bone turnover. It could also mean liver disease, she points out. When is this blood test usually given? The blood test is pretty common. It's measured, ALP is measured as part of a comprehensive metabolic panel, which is a standard blood test measured as part of routine health examinations, Dr. Cusano says. Why is it important to detect osteoporosis early? Getting a head start on osteoporosis means that your doctors can start treatment before you develop a fracture, Dr. Cusano says. Osteoporosis is a silent disease in that there are no symptoms until a patient fractures, she points out. Dr. Osei Boma agrees. Treatment is effective when osteoporosis is detected early, he says. As far as prevention, experts suggest keeping tabs on your nutrition, including getting enough calcium and protein, and working in weight-bearing exercise. Next, we have the article, Three Simple Ways to Stop People-Pleasing. Yes, you really can undo a lifetime of putting others first. This article was written by Jesse Van Amberg and published January 1st, 2026. Do you say yes to every request, no matter how annoying the ask or how little time you have? Is your default answer, I'll do whatever, when making plans with friends? Do you bite your tongue when your mother-in-law shades your parenting skills because you'd rather absorb an insult than cause friction? Congratulations, you're a people pleaser. The term sounds like no big deal, but it's a dirty word on psychology TikTok for a reason. It's more than trying to make other people happy, says Terry Cole, MSW, LCSW, a psychotherapist and the author of Boundary Boss. It's really about trying to avoid other people's displeasure, rejection, or criticism. Being considerate of the needs and feelings of others isn't a bad thing, of course, says Nedra Glover Tawab, MSW, LCSW, a therapist and the author of Set Boundaries, Find Peace. But when you constantly do it to the detriment of yourself, and your needs are never in the forefront, or you even pretend to not have any so that others are happy, it's problematic. Cole adds that putting others first at the expense of yourself breeds bitterness and frustration. The people who you're supposed to be the closest with don't even know you, she says, since you're rarely upfront about your feelings or desires. Your key to unlocking this cycle? Boundaries. They're your preferences, limits, and deal breakers, says Cole. If stop people-pleasing is on your 2026 bucket list, start with these micro-boundaries, suggests Lizette Sanchez, PhD, a psychologist and the founder of Calathea Wellness in Los Angeles. With practice, they'll help you find your voice and honor your needs in everyday situations. Number one, say no to the automatic yes. Starting now, pledge to wait 24 hours before responding to any request or invite, suggests Tawab. Before you say yes, just give it a beat, she says. Hitting the brakes with a simple, let me check my schedule and get back to you tomorrow, can provide the necessary space to check in with yourself about whether you can, or want to, help your friend move, go to that concert, or host your mom's surprise birthday party. It is so much easier to come back and give an authentic no when you haven't already given a reactive yes, agrees Cole. Number two, memorize these no alternatives. It's a mantra here at Oprah Daily that no is a complete sentence, but it's hard to go straight to an unfiltered no after a lifetime of yesing. Ease in with these softer, but still direct, phrases from Tawab and Cole. Let's look at another time to do this. Are there any other options? Keep me posted in the future, but this won't work for me right now. I already have plans. Have a wonderful party. Dinner at 9 p.m. is a little late for me. Let's have lunch another day. Number 3. Lean on body language. Sometimes words fail us, particularly when we're in a tricky social situation, like a work meeting or a family gathering. Cole says you can still assert yourself with body language, like putting your hand up if a coworker keeps talking over you, or turning around and leaving the room if Uncle Mike makes an off-color joke that doesn't sit right with you. Your message and boundaries will still read loud and clear. Our last article is titled, Oprah Invites You to a New Conversation About Kids and Social Media. Children are growing up under a digital pressure that can distort everything from their sleep to their self-worth to their relationships. This article was written by Oprah Winfrey, published January 4th, 2026. Happy New Year, insiders. Right before the holidays, we finally got a positive headline. Australia started enforcing new age limits meant to keep kids under 16 off major social media platforms. It felt like a rare moment of adults saying loud and clear, childhood matters. The news took me right back to my conversations last year with The Anxious Generation author Jonathan Haidt for our Life You Want series on teen mental health and the Oprah podcast. His work has helped so many parents make sense of a highly concerning reality. Children are growing up under a digital pressure that can distort everything from their sleep to their self-worth to their relationships. Now, that connection has come full circle. Haidt has teamed up with science journalist Catherine Price, who has joined me for a separate Life You Want class focused on joy and attention, to write The Amazing Generation, a book that invites and empowers kids to join the conversation. So, insiders, might I suggest you take a little break from social media? It could be a phone-free meal or half an hour of baking, stretching, or laughing with family or friends. What is your screen-free moment going to be? Wishing you a steady start to the year ahead. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Allie Irving, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel. Maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are.